Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With editorials in both Monday's New York Times and Los Angeles Times warning about intensified government efforts to not just go after whistleblowers and leakers, but journalists too, we'll begin with Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project. He has represented or helped over 5,000 whistleblowers, and we will discuss the spy hunt for whistleblowers in the FDA and efforts in Congress to strengthen whistleblower protection laws that Senators Kyl and Sessions are trying to sabotage. Then we will speak with Princeton historian Julian Zelizer about the Romney campaign's attempts to portray President Obama as the anti-capitalist candidate and enemy of free enterprise, who, according to Mitt Romney, wants Americans to be ashamed of success. The author of Governing America, The Revival of Political History, Julian Zelizer, has an article at CNN, Campaign 2012, The Phony War of Markets versus Government. Then finally, historian and political economist Guy Alpovitz joins us, a former legislative director in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. He is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and the author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. We will discuss his op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Wall Street is Too Big to Regulate. Joining us now is Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest organization that champions the rights of whistleblowers. During his 30 years at the Government Accountability Project, he has represented or informally helped over 5,000 whistleblowers to defend themselves against retaliation and make a difference. He has authored and co-authored numerous books, including Courage Without Martyrdom, The Whistleblower Survival Guide, The Art of Anonymous Activism, and The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth, which won the award as the International Business Book of the Year at the 2011 Frankfurt Book Fair. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Devine.
Howdy.
So, Tom, there's an editorial in Monday's New York Times, The Spy Hunt for Whistleblowers, about this very intense sweep at the Food and Drug Administration in their effort to spy on the communications of employees they suspected of whistleblowing. And then in the Los Angeles Times, there's an editorial as well talking about how the government is, in terms of trying to plug leaks, talking about targeting journalists, in particular the House Judiciary Subcommittee, testimony from Representative Trey Gowdy suggesting that they should go after journalists. The fact that these two major newspapers have talked about assaults on whistleblowers and very zealous activities on the part of the government to plug leaks, what's your overall picture you can give us of where the protection of whistleblowers is at the moment?
Well, whistleblowers have almost no ability to defend themselves if the government does act against them. And this latest phenomenon pretty much brings Big Brother into almost every office in the government.
You're talking about this ability to use spyware on government-issued laptops in the case of the...
That's absolutely right. The government is targeting whistleblowers not just using spyware on the computers, but engaging in general electronic surveillance. And in fact, it's not just whistleblowers. That's kind of a special campaign. The government is making copies of records of all electronic communications by citizens generally. The National Security Agency is doing that, and it's because of whistleblowers we know about it. It's no wonder they're being targeted.
So, in other words, the whistleblowers inside the NSA are telling us that the government are doing this on a routine basis to what, any or all citizens?
To all citizens, engaging electronic surveillance of any electronic communications, whether it's telephone, landline or mobile phones, emails, use of the internet. We've basically lost our right to privacy in the name of national security.
Well, that's a very weighty subject, and I certainly don't want to avoid it, but we'll get back to that. But let's just talk about the FDA case here, which the New York Times have written about it. What specifically happened there was that a subsidiary of GE Healthcare, a unit of General Electric, apparently were concerned about an article that appeared in the New York Times that talked about a CAT scan machine made by General Electric that was emitting unwarranted radiation and was a risk to patients being screened for colon cancer, that prompted the FDA then to install this spyware and screen five scientists that they thought were involved in the leak. And this apparently meant that their laptops at both at home and work were tapped into. You're saying that this is a fairly pervasive government activity? This is not just an overzealous employer at the Food and Drug Administration?
It's not just the FDA. We've seen that at GAP, at NSA, at the Department of Agriculture, at the Department of Defense. And the irony is that this is illegal under the Whistleblower Protection Act. It's a violation of the Act to open a retaliatory investigation because someone engaged in protected activity. And the FDA scientists certainly would qualify under the whistleblower law for protection. There's a horrible problem with a breakdown in best laboratory practices and industry favoritism for medical devices. And it's a good thing that they brought up these issues. The biggest irony, though, is that not all of the FDA scientists are covered by the Whistleblower Protection Act. Due to a quirky 2009 court decision, members of the Public Health Service are excluded from the X protection. And that means that it can be open season on PHS scientists, who are some of the most significant for public health and safety in the government. And we're trying our hardest to get that plugged in upcoming legislation to overhaul the Whistleblower Protection Act. And Congress is on the spot to make sure that these whistleblowers have legal rights.
So in the case of the five scientists at the FDA that the government went after, what's the procedure for them to protect themselves under the Whistleblower Act? Because weren't some of them fired, or all of them fired?
That's right. They've all been forced out of the government, and the ones who aren't in the Public Health Service can get help from the U.S. Office of Special Counsel or just file an appeal. And the Office of Special Counsel is investigating to try and get relief for those scientists who are covered by the Act. But as I said, some of them are in the Public Health Service. And for them, the only thing they can fall back on is the Military Whistleblower Protection Act. For some reason, because they wear a uniform, it doesn't matter that they're not part of the military and that they're performing civilian functions. They only can get help under the Military Whistleblower Law. And no one has even gotten a hearing since that law was passed in 1988 to challenge termination. It's a graveyard for whistleblower rights. There's a very serious loophole. And Congress is poised to overhaul the whistleblower law, and this really better be part of it.
Again, I'm speaking with Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest organization that champions the rights of whistleblowers. And during his 30 years at the Government Accountability Project, Tom has represented or informally helped over 5,000 whistleblowers to defend themselves against retaliation. Now, just for the audience to understand this, Tom, there are these protections, but they're not often used, and you say the military one hasn't been used at all, and then it seems to have arbitrarily cover some people and not other people. What is the procedure? Because recently we saw on 60 Minutes a couple of fighter pilots who went public over the F-22 Raptor, this $500 million a copy plane that doesn't work, and the oxygen supplies is causing pilots to black out, and they've lost one pilot, and the pilots that fly them simply don't want to risk their lives, and the Air Force doesn't know what's going on, and these guys, at the behest of a congressman who was protecting them, went on 60 Minutes and went public. It sounds like it takes a lot of support from people in Congress and in the media for you not to get hung out to dry here if you're a whistleblower.
Well, it takes a legal campaign that's almost like winning a political election for a whistleblower to commit the truth and get away with it, survive professionally. And that's the point of the overhaul of free speech rights for government employees that Congress is on the verge of enacting. They've been working for 13 years on evening the score so that whistleblowers have a fighting chance of defending themselves and getting more normal access to court. And we're right on the verge of this getting passed. The last two Congresses, there was near unanimous support, but in the last week and then the last Congress, the last hour before adjournment, secret holds were put on the legislation to block its enactment. This year, we're keeping our fingers crossed. They're going to get this bill done early enough so that it can overcome procedural sabotage, and whistleblowers will actually have some rights that are worth the paper they're written on.
So can you tell us who's for and against this legislation, who's blocking it, even though the secret holds? What's your suspicions?
Well, the secret holds were exposed. We did a search for the secret killer campaign with NPR. And in the last two Congresses, they were Senators John Kyle and Senator John Sessions, the number two Republican in the Senate and the ranking Republican in the Senate Judiciary Committee. To make the plot even more Machiavellian, the holds at the end of the 2010 Congress were at the request of the Senate offices told me they didn't have a problem with the bill. It was done as a professional courtesy at the request of the incoming House of Representatives leadership. The new Republican leadership that had just campaigned and won an election on fighting abuses of big government and helping the little guys defend the taxpayers. And they blocked this law at the last Congress. We're hoping that they won't have the gall to do it again.
And, you know, I can't imagine how they justify this. You know, obviously you pointed out the hypocrisy of their ideology of wanting to get government off our back. I take it that in the case of this FDA, these FDA whistleblowers, it was General Electric that were being embarrassed because they were making machines that emit dangerous radiation to patients. So I take it that they're protecting big business, Ryan.
Well, that just raises very serious questions about who the FDA is serving. They find out that some machines are endangering patients and go after the people who exposed the hazard instead of going after the company that's not acting lawfully. Things get a little bit surreal here, and that's why whistleblowers says the human factor are indispensable to keeping government honest. Whistleblowers are the people who risk their careers for what the House Republicans said they stood for in all their campaign slogans. And it's time for those same politicians to start defending the people who live their rhetoric.
So Tom Devine, again, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest organization that champions the rights of whistleblowers. And during Tom's 30 years at the Government Accountability Project, he has represented or informally helped over 5,000 whistleblowers defend themselves against retaliation. So let's talk about what you said earlier, though, which is really disturbing, and that is that the National Security Agency basically have the ability and are doing so. Basically, they can put any or all American citizens under surveillance. So tell us how you know about this and why it is not a bigger story, and why aren't, you know, I mean, there is a possibility of this being a bipartisan issue in terms of outrage, isn't it? Aren't there some conservatives like Ron Paul and others who are afraid of a Big Brother, as well as a lot of liberals like Henry Waxman and others who are trying to rein in government abuse?
Well, GAP is in coalitions with dozens and dozens of conservative NGOs whose views are exactly as you summarized, Ian. They're genuinely committed to defending individual freedom against government abuses of power, and Big Brother is their worst nightmare. And they're standing in line lockstep and working hand in glove with me to strengthen the rights for whistleblowers at agencies like NSA in the upcoming legislation. The problem isn't the grassroots conservatives. It's the politicians in Congress. And unfortunately, too many of the key congressional oversight offices have become very cozy with what's known as the intelligence community. The congressional staff and the intelligence community staff go back and forth between the bureaucracy and Congress. And they view their primary mission as shielding the intelligence community's work, and as they're very shrill about the most draconian measures against anybody who could be suspected of leaking and exposing the intelligence community to public oversight.
But specifically, you were saying earlier that what the FDA did to these five scientists by putting spyware on their government laptops and watching everything that they did and eventually firing them, you're saying that the National Security Agency has that ability which they can use against any or all U.S. citizens?
That's right, and they have been gathering that information. Thank goodness they haven't had the confidence to be able to analyze it, so it's not necessarily available to engage in any effective recreation of an American citizen's history. But this is the case. It was exposed by top-level engineers and professionals at NSA, and the government went after them in response to it, being concerned that they might be leakers to the New York Times when they broke this story and exposed the broad domestic surveillance a few years ago. There was some national publicity on it because the government tried to prosecute one of those individuals, Mr. Thomas Drake, under the Espionage Act. And he hadn't disclosed any classified information to anyone. He'd been working with the Inspector General. All the whistleblowers had been working with the Inspector General. And somehow that made them targets for the Justice Department's anti-leaks investigation. They stayed within the system. But when the government tried to prosecute Mr. Drake, that was publicized, and the prosecution was effectively withdrawn. It was reduced to just a token token probation sort of charge. They were trying to put him in jail for over 30 years. Other whistleblowers from the NSA group, such as Mr. William Binney, are working very hard to expose the extent of the domestic surveillance. In fact, he was on Democracy Now! Recently. Jesselyn Raddick from the Government Accountability Project is leading our efforts with all of these folks to fight in to fight the surveillance. And in fact, I think Jess has a column every day in the Daily Kos that goes into some of the latest examples.
Well, just in closing, Tom Devine, the House Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing on going after not just leakers, but journalists. Representative Trey Gowdy, Republican of South Carolina, suggested that you should put journalists in front of a grand jury. You either answer the question or you're going to be held in contempt and go to jail, which is what I thought all reporters aspire to do anyway. Gives you an idea of his sort of attitude to the role of journalists. And also in the same hearing, an Army intelligence officer, Ken Allard, went after the New York Times, and particularly David Sanger, for revealing that the U.S. engaged in cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear program, saying that Sanger penetrated the Obama White House as effectively as any foreign agent. So they're talking about, as far as I know, the Espionage Act has never been used to target journalists in the last 70 years, has it?
Not to my knowledge. There's just no question that the government is abusing its authority with respect to our privacy. It's grossly abusing this authority. And right now, but the only ones that we've got to help expose this and alert us to it and warn us are the whistleblowers, the people who haven't lost their humanity inside these government bureaucracies and who are willing to stick their necks out and risk getting fired or even prosecuted in order to commit the truth. And another aspect of this upcoming legislation, the whistleblower law, Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, it's called, is that it would extend Whistleblower Protection Act rights to members of the intelligence community, such as employees at NSA. They're like the Public Health Service. They can't defend themselves. It's not illegal to engage in, under statute, to engage in a retaliatory investigation of them currently. If Congress finally acts on this law, they'll have some rights too to defend themselves when they're defending the public. And it's quite ironic to me that it's the House Judiciary Committee who's targeting the journalists and saying they're going to haul them into court. Well, it's the House Judiciary Committee that's said they would kill this year's whistleblower bill if it included jury trials for the whistleblowers when they're fired in retaliation for defending the public. They said the same thing about normal access to the appeals courts to review the administrative rulings. It seems like there's one set of rules for the government bureaucracy, and there's another set of rules for people who are challenging abuses of power by the government bureaucracy. And the ones who want to have this double standard are the conservatives in Congress. There's just something very wrong with that picture. I hope the conservatives among our population will start to hold these politicians accountable.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Tom Devine.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, which is a non-profit, non-partisan public interest organization that champions the rights of whistleblowers. During his 30 years at the Government Accountability Project, he has represented or informally helped over 5,000 whistleblowers to defend themselves against retaliation. He has authored and co-authored numerous books, including Courage Without Martyrdom, The Whistleblower Survival Guide, The Art of Anonymous Activism, and The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide, A Handbook for Committing the Truth, which won the award as International Business Book of the Year at the 2011 Frankfurt Book Fair. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the phony war between markets versus government in the presidential campaign.
Your name is Big Brother. You say that you are watching me on the telly. See me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidi-bidi-rich idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico and has written for The New York Times and The Washington Post. His most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest book is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, Campaign 2012, The Phony War of Markets versus Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly this is a, at least, I guess if Mitt Romney has his way, he'll make this the central issue of the campaign. Anything but talking about his taxes and his tenure at Bain Capital. Is that too cynical?
Yes, I think it's cynical, but it's also, it's correct. I mean, I think Mitt Romney originally wanted to make this campaign about his business record. The president has clearly been able to turn this against him. And I think right now Romney's trying to shift and to try to figure out a way to reframe this debate to put it back more on Obama's record and the kind of ideology he represents.
But it's what he's doing, though, is something that he's done from day one. The first commercial that he made in Iowa when he was running against Republicans was not against any Republican challenger, but against Barack Obama. And he put essentially John McCain's words in Obama's mouth. Obama was quoting something that McCain had said in the 2008 campaign, old footage from then, and then he put it out as though Obama was making the statement, which was damaging. It seems to me that that's what he's been doing all along. And this latest commercial that he's essentially, they are Obama's words, but they're entirely out of context about how much infrastructure has contributed towards private enterprise.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a two-front strategy. The first, Romney has very clearly just come back to the theme of look at where the economy is, and then to blame the president for where the economy is and to raise questions about his policies. The second is to paint him as a quote-unquote big government liberal and to use quotes and statements such as we just saw recently to suggest that President Obama doesn't respect the market economy and that ultimately he believes in some kind of centralized, you know, command and control economy. And I think those are the two themes. The one thing about Mitt Romney is he sticks to his themes, and you're correct. This goes back to the primary, and I don't think it's going to change going into November.
Well, but I'm describing something that, to my mind, is actually deeply dishonest, and I'm sort of surprised at how Romney has been able to sort of whine and with indignation say that what Obama's saying about his taxes and about his tenure at Bain Capital is beneath the presidency. I mean, I don't see anybody, you know, fighting back by saying to Romney, well, you're using distortions and manipulating statements is deeply dishonest. I mean, in other words, I don't know how the pot gets away with calling the kettle black.
Well, that's true. To be fair, we've seen this before in other campaigns, not from Mitt Romney, but from other candidates. You know, you remember back in 2008 when Joe the Plumber made his famous appearance, and in discussions about where President Obama stood on taxes, they started to call him essentially a socialist. I mean, that language actually entered into the lexicon of the campaign. And obviously, you know, Barack Obama is far from a socialist. He's a, you know, in many ways a Bill Clinton era Democrat on economic policy, but it stuck. The word got out there. The idea got out there, and then really since his presidency, there's been a contingent of Republicans certainly that have been able to make these claims, even though they have little to do with reality, they have little to do with President Obama's record. That's the political world we live in right now. So you can do that. You can then accuse your opponent of distortions. I think there is a atmosphere in the current media age where people don't know what's up and down or what's left or right. And it gives politicians a lot of room to just throw charges out there, and they stick or they at least confuse the electorate. And it's a dangerous kind of political game. It's certainly not a productive atmosphere to have debates about these big issues.
So I suppose, Julian Zelizer, given the current polls, for you would think that Obama having, or at least I guess Romney got himself in this position, but Obama's clearly taking advantage of the fact that in terms of Romney's tenure at Bain, he either lied to the American people or lied to the SEC, and also the extent to which the Obama campaign are running ads. I believe they're resuming them fairly soon. So they took a bit of a hiatus because of the shooting in Aurora, Colorado. But these new ads basically say that that the reason that Romney won't release his taxes is that in one or more years he didn't pay any taxes at all or very little. And I assume they must have some information that they're basing it on. I believe the candidate Romney gave 23 years of tax returns to the McCain campaign. And my understanding is that well, do you think there's any reason why McCain didn't choose Romney back then? Obviously, he made a pretty poor choice in Sarah Palin.
He did, but it is, you know, very hard to speculate what McCain's thought was. You know, this image of a flip-flopper was at the time seen as very damaging. Romney's record in Massachusetts was seen as damaging. His inability to connect with the Republican base was seen as damaging. There are a lot of reasons out there beyond tax returns to see why a McCain might have gone and did go in a different direction. So I don't know what's in the tax returns. It could be there's some embarrassing information, some you know, questionable information, or it could be, you know, this is a case of where, you know, candidates get stuck on a position involving themselves, and their defense and stonewalling turns into something bigger than they intended. I don't know, and I don't know why McCain did it, but certainly if this recent few days doesn't just turn media direction in the media in another direction, it's something that Romney's going to have to resolve, or this will be the story for weeks on end.
Well, the point, though, that I find fascinating, Julian Zelizer, is that in spite of what seems to be a fairly damaging narrative, and, you know, and I assume it will return shortly, and he'll be back on the hot seat, Romney will, about his taxes and his tenure at Bain, that apparently, according to the latest CBS New York Times polls, particularly in Virginia, it's not making any difference. So I guess maybe there's an alternative universe out there that, you know, the Beltway punditry.
Well, there is. I mean, yeah. Look, this is an election where you have a handful of states is going to decide the outcome. Both candidates are pouring an enormous amount of resources into those states. And certainly the White House is unhappy that with this barrage of attacks, with many, a lot of damaging information, really able to shift attention toward Romney's record. You're right, the polls are not moving very much. Is there an alternative universe? Yes, that is the Republican universe is not being swayed at this point by these attacks, and certainly their anger and animosity toward Obama can be greater than what they see as some of the flaws in Mitt Romney's record. I'm not sure they're all convinced that something illegal happened. Many of them are buying Mitt Romney's defense, which is this is the free market, and that's clearly how the Republicans want to change the narrative. This is an attack on standard market practices. But what we do know is what you just said. The polls are not moving, and the administration ultimately has to be careful. These kinds of attacks sometimes don't bear the fruit, and they, you know, move the president away from touting his own agenda and talking to the country about what he wants to do. So there are some risks for the president, especially if the polls don't move.
So, but in your article at CNN, Julian Zelizer, Campaign 2012, The Phony War of Markets versus Government, you lay out a very, very clear case that going back to FDR, the Democrats have been very, very pro-capitalist. I mean, arguably, Franklin Delano Roosevelt rescued capitalism from itself, even though he was vilified by a lot of the capitalists of the day. I mean, assuming that facts and history and reality matters in this debate, just walk us through the brief history going from FDR to the present that makes it very clear that Democratic presidents in the modern era have all been very, very pro-capitalist.
Yeah, that's a standard history lesson. FDR, his goal was not to destroy capitalism or even really to transform it. It was to save it. And FDR believed that without government, without protecting workers, without allowing people to unionize and providing a base of economic security, that ultimately that was a greater risk to capitalism than anything else you could do. Lyndon Johnson, with his programs, he also was very determined to bring more people into the capitalist system, not to somehow destroy it. The war on poverty, the goal was to make people self-sufficient and independent economic actors so that they could enjoy the amazing economic growth of that period. And then since then, Democrats moved very much to the center, where all of a sudden Lyndon Johnson and FDR looked much more to the left. So Jimmy Carter talked about deficit reduction. He was the champion of deregulation. Bill Clinton supported globalism and bringing the market to more people as the solution to many of our problems. And so the Democrats really, you know, mainstream Democrats have never been anti-market. They've never been anti-capitalism, and it's just the opposite. The whole argument was that some level of government intervention was necessary to create the strongest capitalist system possible. So it's a false argument, and it works on the campaign trail, but it has really little to do with the history that you can quickly see.
Well, I think you can add to that, Julian Zelizer, that Bill Clinton, who of course presided over the end of the Glass-Steagall Act that had served the country well since the Depression, and we know the results of that, the financialization of American capitalism, of course, is an issue in itself. And do you think that Obama can make that distinction between the new financialization of capitalism, where close to half of the economy now is controlled by Wall Street. They don't really produce anything except profits for themselves. They extract wealth. They don't create wealth by and large. And, you know, what I think most of our ideas of capitalism come from the early era, surely.
It's an attractive argument. And obviously the argument that we support the parts of capitalism that produce products that bring, you know, the greatest amount of wealth to the greatest portion of the population, rather than a financially based economy where, you know, a few people get a lot of the wealth, and the kinds of services that are offered are really about making money. That's a tough argument to make on the campaign trail. It lacks a certain clarity, especially when people are primarily concerned about jobs. And I think the president is having a little trouble gaining traction with that. Also, his own record with Wall Street is not one that's very adversarial, despite all the rhetoric. And I think people who are savvy enough to follow politics know that Obama's been supported by a lot of these financial industry titans. The Wall Street, for a long time, did very well for Obama. And so the campaign finance system itself, I think, undercuts some of Obama's ability to make an argument that's already difficult to make.
Well, just in closing, though, you have the current argument is basically the Romney campaign have taken Obama's remarks about how government infrastructure actually helped businesses succeed. They didn't do it on their own, and that's turned into Obama attacking capitalists, saying that they don't deserve to be successful on their own. Clearly, not what he said. And not what he thinks. But that is, I think, one version of how a government and capitalism interact. And the other way that you can look at capitalism from the Republican point of view is that they seem to see, in many cases, seem to see government as a huge piggy bank that you can raid, agribusiness, the military-industrial complex. The most outrageous one of all, of course, is the for-profit colleges, which simply take government money and charge it back to poor, unsuspecting students at usurious rates and give them worthless diplomas. And that costs the Treasury $40 billion a year. And you turn on your TV set, all you see is advertisements for these new colleges, and by the way, the advertisements that you're watching, that's your tax dollars at work. So there's plenty of examples of how government and industry work together, and some of them, actually, you could make a strong critique about the worst form of government-private interaction.
The history of government and markets interacting goes beyond FDR, and some of the examples you're giving you could find in the 19th century. You know, the development of our information system came through the mail. A lot of our roads that were essential to merchants were constructed with government funds and often through government workers. So there is this collaboration. It's a history that liberals until the 70s were very proud about. The TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, was always a great model of how this kind of partnership should work. I think Obama needs to make that case. Look, his record is the stimulus in terms of the economy, and then he's still calling for these kinds of partnerships. And he has to talk about this. He has to talk about how the Internet comes out of government research projects, not just private market research projects. The examples are all over the place, but I do think the president's had some trouble getting that out. And he certainly had trouble responding when the words are twisted and turned into an attack on the free market. So I think this is the debate that we're going to have in the next few months, and part of this will be who can make a more aggressive case about what the nature of this relationship is.
Specifically, Romney came at the president over these distorted remarks, or these remarks that used out of context, by saying that, according to Romney, that the president's basically saying that Steve Jobs didn't deserve to be successful. And the truth of the matter is that Steve Jobs, the first computer he ever saw was at a government lab. And, of course, the Internet was created through DARPA, through government funds. So what about making this case then that, you know, traditional welfare in the European social democracy context is pretty hard to find here in the United States, but There's lots of examples of what you could arguably call right-wing welfare.
I think, obviously, I don't think Obama wants to say it in a negative light, meaning if he says that, he'll probably just fuel some of the arguments and anger of the right. I think what he needs to make is a positive case about what the government has done to strengthen the nation's economy. And instances such as an Apple, even if it's distorted, he has to come back to that. But he certainly has to map out what does he want to do in the next 4 years and what's government role going to be in revitalizing the U.S. economy, and talk about that kind of partnership. That is the case he has to make. And as much as Romney distorts it, he has to respond back in aggressive fashion. And I think as much as he's tempted to say there's all kinds of businesses that benefit from government, or just look at TARP as the ultimate government bailout, he also has to spin a positive story, and that will help him to make the case that he doesn't lack an economic vision. He doesn't lack an answer to the economic crisis the country's facing. Whether he can do that, I have no idea. But that's clearly going to be one of the big challenges in the next few months.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN and Politico, and has written for The New York Times and The Washington Post. His most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, Campaign 2012, The Phony War of Markets versus Government. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Gar Alperovitz about nationalizing the Wall Street banks. And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done, for you and your children. Yeah, you Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gar Alperovitz, who's a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow at King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute for Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also served as a legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He's the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors of the New Economic Institute. His most recent book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And he has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Wall Street is Too Big to Regulate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gar Alperovitz.
Good to be with you.
And Wall Street may well be too big to regulate, but your notion that maybe the solution is to nationalize them, I'm sure. Do you think Jamie Dimon is quaking in his boots?
Not at the moment. But, what's really interesting is that I look back at some of the powerful thinkers of the most conservative doctrines at the Chicago School of Economics, and I was taking and applying their theories to the current situation. And number one was obviously the theory of regulatory capture. And the old Chicago School economists understood, as most people do when they're honest about it, that these big corporations of any kind, banks or other, they take over the regulators indirectly. They take over the congressional committees indirectly, so that after a while they are clothing their own policies with government regulations and government power. So you don't get much regulation. It's not a very fancy insight. I mean, anybody who's reading the paper or watching what's happening with regulation now understands this. You have to be kind of blind not to. But they also were very interesting, and they said, you know, if you try to break them up, they regroup. The big fish eat the little fish, and you're right back where you started. Now, these are the free market economists I'm talking about. So if you can't regulate them, and if you can't break them up and keep them broken up, because they'll regroup and be back where you started, these old conservative economists said, well, in some cases, the only answer, literally, from a free market position, is to take them over and nationalize them and neutralize them so you can have free competition. Very interesting argument, I think correct in its basic dimensions, particularly if you apply it to the banks.
Well, indeed, the examples of when the antitrust when antitrust happened in the case of Standard Oil and more recently AT&T, as you point out, when they were broken up, they've essentially recombined a few decades later.
Yep, that's what happened, and it happens even more dramatically now because the financing situation of the banks allows them to leverage huge amounts of money so they can gobble up almost anything they want to. And once they get going, once they start accumulating, then they get more and more power, and they can take up the little guys, and there you are back where you started. So it's a wonderfully logical dilemma. If you can't regulate them, because they begin to influence the regulators in reality, and as I say, almost anyone in Washington, I live in Washington, and the lobbyists are swarming and outnumbering, you know, the regulators 10 to 1, They're very high-priced and very smart lobbyists that paid a lot of money. And the regulations have a lot of loopholes. That's the way you do it. And if they're going to regroup, the logic leads you to this wonderful conclusion from the conservative Chicago. These are Milton Friedman's teachers who are put this forward. This is not the left. You've got to neutralize them, and the only way to do that is nationalize them. So that's basically the argument I put forward in the New York Times, and I was glad to see that the Times ran the piece, and we're starting to get some debate going on it.
Well, there's no question, Guy Rapovitz, that the President Obama is in the kind of democratic liberal tradition, going back to FDR, Truman, Johnson, and Clinton, and you know that they believe that you can regulate, and in fact, in Clinton's case, of course, he undid the centerpiece of regulation, which was Glass-Steagall, and essentially the problem is now surely that because of the line between investment banking and regular banking means that the investment bankers used to have their own skin in the game, and now they've got the money of all these poor hapless depositors that they profligately throw around and create monstrous problems like the 2008 almost near-death experience of the global economy. And then, of course, they are too big to fail, and then we have to rescue them.
Yeah, it's exactly what happens. But there's an interesting dimension. I was just talking a minute ago about the current regulatory process, but bringing up Clinton and what happened to Glass-Steagall, there's another dimension of the problem. Because the strong regulatory structures that we did have were put in place partly in the Progressive Era and above all in the New Deal. And in the post-war period, when there was a much stronger progressive politics and mainly backed up by labor unions, in all countries, the progressive politics has to have a strong labor component or it doesn't get anywhere. But labor has declined from 34% of the labor force being organized to a mere 7% in the private sector now. And I think we're seeing the reflection of that in just what you're talking about. So it wasn't only the abandoning Glass-Steagall, the division that prevented the divided between investment and ordinary banking. That went the ways, but airlines were deregulated, trucking was deregulated. Basically, the same situation's happening in cable television. So if you look around, there is a larger process of not administrative deregulation, but in this case, legislative deregulation, which reflects these underlying power relationships. There was an era long ago when you probably could regulate to a certain degree. That's long past, both because of the way they take over the regulators and because they write the laws in a new way that when the laws are written, you get deregulation of another kind. So we're in another era, and in a funny way, those old Chicago School conservative economists way back in the 30s, they had an insight into this that I don't think anybody has surpassed, and it's good to go back and read them and start applying the lessons, I think, to where we're going now. Otherwise, the logic of it is, you know, I read this stuff pretty closely and know a lot of the financial analysts. I don't know anybody who doesn't believe we're going to have another financial crisis, and because there's so many loopholes in the regulation. And when that happens, either the next one or the one after that, I think at some point the light bulb's going to go on and say, look, this is too important to leave to the banks themselves, and we can't regulate them. So somehow the only option is probably the one these old Chicago school guys saw, which is to take them over, make them into public utilities, and stabilize the situation that they can cause too much damage the way they're now running.
Again, I'm speaking with Gary Alperovitz, who's a historian and political economist. He served as a legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and he's the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland, and his most recent book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, and he has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Wall Street is Too Big to Regulate. So I got a little sidetracked there with Clinton and Glass-Steagall, but it's a very important point, and I'm glad you followed up on it. But I was going to say Obama, being a traditional Democratic Party liberal, he believes, obviously, that he can fix it, and he's got the Dodd-Frank law. But only one-third of that has been implemented. I mean, they're just nibbling that thing to death, the lobbyists. And we know that the banking lobby is about the most pervasive on Capitol Hill, second only probably to the NRA and the military-industrial complex. But
very, very, very well paid, very intelligent, very sophisticated. And the other piece of this is, you know, the people who are doing the regulation, you know, they're making government salaries. And they're kind of sitting opposite people who are making one, two, three, maybe 10 times what they're making. And they're thinking about their next job. And I'm not saying they're corrupt, but I'm saying there's a kind of subtle kind of implication in many of these cases that they may move on to better things in the future. And so it's a very, very, very kind of unreal world that they live in. Aside from the fact that they're over, you know, they're understaffed, outgunned, too many people attacking them with different ideas all the time and different legal suits and challenges. So it's just not a viable way to manage a regulatory structure, and that's reality. It's not. I think pretty much anybody in Washington knows that's true, that the regulation is full of holes as a result. So the bottom line, there will probably be another crisis. You know, household wealth lost $19 trillion in the last crisis. $19 trillion, not a billion. So the stakes are very, very high in all of this as to whether or not the regulations are put in place. We're not talking about minor issues. We're talking about the entire U.S. economy going down again when these people, blow it again with some speculative effort. So these are very important questions to get straight.
Well, it's interesting that that $19 billion of wealth was lost essentially by the American middle class and by those aspiring to the middle class, who are largely the victims of the subprime ripoff. Interesting enough, yesterday I was just talking about with the leading tax authority in the country, David K. Johnston, about the fact that $21 trillion of the wealth of the global elite is hidden in offshore tax havens, complete black hole, totally unproductive wealth. So there you have it. $19 trillion this is Robin Hood in reverse, isn't it? You take away $19 trillion from America's middle class, impoverish them. Meanwhile, $21 trillion is sitting offshore doing nothing for anybody except the rich.
Yeah, there's you know, something's a building in terms of the sense that there's really something so fundamentally out of line here when people can, on the one hand, make so much money and on the other hand, cause so much damage. It gets beyond ideology in a sense. That's why, as I say, it's very interesting. These are not socialists calling for nationalization. These are the conservatives who taught Milton Friedman. In the interest of stabilizing the system and kind of getting rid of these extraordinary costs that are imposed on everybody else by virtue of the greed and malfeasance of these big corporations. So I think what you're saying and what's implicit in all this is, as the economic pain gets deeper and the next go round, I think people are going to be, you know, left, right, Tea Party as well as the Occupy people and a lot of people in the middle saying something new has got to be done. And one of the things we can look at is what these old conservative economists were saying. If you can't regulate them and you can't break them up, take them over and make them into public utilities. At least they'll be stable, and we need that stability.
But as you point out, though, in your article in the New York Times, Gar Albovitz, Wall Street is too big to regulate, that these old-school conservative economists were talking about banks back then. Now they're far more concentrated with the five biggest banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs. Their combined assets amounting to more than half of the nation's economy. So the other issue, of course, is the financialization of our economy, where we have an economic model which is about extracting money, extracting wealth and not creating wealth, and that doesn't seem to be sustainable in the long term. But what you also point out is that nationalization, which of course makes people hysterical on the right, is actually not very difficult, and we tend to forget that we've already nationalized General Motors back in 2009. The government still owns the controlling shares of its stock, and we already nationalized American International Group, the largest, world's largest insurance company. The government owns roughly 60% of that. So if it happens, it can happen with alacrity and ease, surely.
Yeah, and people do tend to forget. We nationalized two big auto companies because that was the only way to solve the problem. Unfortunately, we're sort of giving them back, and we'll see if that will work. But, you know, the government put in something the equivalent of 61% of the assets in some of the major banks, like Bank of America, when we bailed them out. Yeah. And that could easily have been, that's what happened last time around, 61%. And it could easily have been voting stock instead of just giving it in away without taking control. And the same of Citigroup, it was, you know, something like 88% of their capitalization, which the government put money in and then let them go free without control. So the de facto investments that the public has made could easily, had we wanted to, and turned into a voting stock. The banks were crawling on their knees. And
right, and now they're completely ungrateful. I thank you so much for joining us, Gar Albovitz. I'm afraid we ran out of time, but I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gar Albovitz, who's a historian, political economist. He's served as a legislative director of the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and was a special assistant to the Department of State. He's a co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and on the board of the New Economic Institute. His latest book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Wall Street is Too Big to Regulate. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.